Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. The protagonist of Terence Greene's novel, Shadow of Ashland, is a 40-year-old Toronto man named Leo Nolan. He's presently in the small city of Ashland, Kentucky, where he's gone in search of a long-lost relative, his Uncle Jack. Jack Rady disappeared 50 years earlier during the depths of the Great Depression, and his last known address was the Scott Hotel in Ashland. Leo is now staying in the same hotel room that Jack lived in. His elderly host, Stan Matusik, remembers Jack well. Here's Michael Hogan, reading from Shadow of Ashland.
The next morning, I spooned instant coffee and sugar into my mug, filled it with water from the bathroom tap, and microwaved it to steaming. I stirred in cream, poured myself a bowl of Cheerios and some orange juice, and broke a banana off the bunch. I pushed the blue upholstered easy chair over to the window, set my breakfast on the ledge there, and sat down to eat, staring out at the sun warming the church turret on Winchester Avenue. Jack, I thought. Jack Rady. Gonna be a hot one. Pulling the door shut behind me, I turned to the source of the voice. Sitting motionless on the veranda swing in the morning shade was Stanley Matusik. How are you this morning? He nodded, as ever. I walked over beside him, then half sat against the railing, facing him. I had the feeling that he had been waiting for me. So what do you think of Ashland? I squinted, looking across the street into the glare. Nice. Then I looked back at him. Very nice. The silence that hovered between us for the next half minute was a good one. Unhurried, patient. Any more on Jack Rady? He asked finally. I squinted once more into the brightness of the morning. He's here somehow, I said. It's all here somehow. Stanley Matusik nodded. Like everything else, he said. There's things that are there all the time. All you got to do is clear your head to see them. A heat bug whined and the air shimmered off the hot pavement. That building there, I pointed along Winchester. Stanley's gaze followed my finger. Bank, he said. Why? I shrugged. Anything special about it? His brow furrowed. Bank's a bank, he said. Looking at its height, I considered this. When was it built? 1920s? Was the Ashland National Bank then? Didn't make it through the Depression, no. Was taken over by the Second National Bank in 32, I think. Changed again only about 4 years ago. Now it's the First Bank and Trust Company. He looked at me. Got more lives than some cats, he said. I let him continue. Not all banks was like that. He was rolling now. By late 32, more than 6,000 banks had locked the doors. That's over one quarter of the banks in the whole country, Mr. Nolan. 9 million people saw their life savings disappear like smoke in thin air while they slept. Happens lots around here. Lots. He shook his head, remembering. But that one. He nodded toward the bank that rose 10 stories above the ground, towering over the downtown core. That one's still there. I sat back, wary of the raw, exposed nerve that I had uncovered. And Jack? I asked suddenly. Stanley seemed to start from the name. Then he frowned. Jack's gone, he said. I said nothing. In my head, I saw Jack smiling, alive and young, in the pristine night. At 7:30 p.m., I walked up the front steps of the pale blue frame house and rang the top buzzer. Within seconds, Jean opened the door and stepped out. She wore a summery cotton top and a white skirt. Her eyes, I noticed, had liner on them, and she was wearing lipstick. And she was wearing perfume, a subtle southern scent. You look great. Thanks. Hope I'm not underdressed. I looked down at myself. You look like $1 million. We started down the steps. Feels like rain. Not for a while, she said. For a while it'll just be hot and the wind'll blow. And then she looked at me. Maybe in the night. You're the expert. She put her arm through mine as we walked, and it felt like it belonged. The chimney corner tea room did indeed look pleasant, more like a cottage than a restaurant. The view from our table through the front window was colored by an array of purple flowers outside. It was a family restaurant, and the better-off families of Ashland were about us, scrubbed clean in shirt sleeves and cotton dresses. When I saw the prices on the menu, though, I spoke up. "This is a cut above McDonald's. I think this one should be on me, too." I tried to sound firm. "Nonsense. Dutch treat, at least." "My treat, Leo Nolan from Canada. Men your age are always trying to buy a woman without even knowing you're doing it." I was chastised. "I didn't mean..." "I know you didn't. It's me has to get it straight in my head, too. Been too many years when I didn't get it myself. I'm asserting myself," she said, a blend of pride and coyness on her face. "Woman has to assert herself. Clear the air." I relaxed, smiling. "Man my age," I said, "is just the right age," she finished. "Just needs a little tuning, like a piano." She smiled. I let her pick the wine. Jean ordered the seafood platter, and I decided to try the catfish, a Kentucky specialty. "They just fry it in batter," she explained. "They do that to everything in Kentucky." I sipped the wine. A California white. She studied me for a long time in silence. Then she said, "You're a cop, right?" "What?" "A cop. A federal agent. What do they have up there in Canada? Mounties?" "Good Lord, Jean. I've gone out with cops. They keep to themselves, like you. And there's always pieces missing from their stories." "I assure you, I am not a cop." I gave her the most sincere look I had. She took a sip from her wine. "Really?" she asked. "I'm just what you see and what I said, nothing more." "What are you doing in Ashland, then? We don't get tourists." I sat back, thinking. She was too observant to play games with, her company too good to lose so quickly. And the bouquet of her perfume, mixed with the warm air and California wine, made me want to share some intimacy. And she deserved as much of the story as any sane person could handle. My mother died in March. Her face straightened. "Oh, I'm sorry." She had a brother whom she hadn't seen for years. Ashland was his last known address, and I came to see if I could find him. She relaxed. Finally, what I was saying rang true for her. "You found him?" "No," I said. "Not really." She waited. "We haven't heard from him for 50 years. She looked incredulous. 50 years? Jeez. "Is he here, still?" I thought of last night. "I don't know," I said. "See," she said, pointing to my catfish. "What'd I tell you?" I looked at it. A Kentucky specialty. I checked the batter. "You were right." I love those words. "Pardon?" "You were right. They just might be a woman's favorites." I smiled. "In my case, it's because I'm not right often enough. But when I am, it feels good." "It feels good for everybody. You don't have to be a woman." I cut into the catfish. "Where do you live in Toronto?" she asked. "I've got an apartment downtown. Any family there?" I chewed, thinking. "My father's still alive. He's 80 years old. What about you?" I asked. "I met your mom. And my dad's there, too. And an older sister. Just the two of us." "She live in Ashland?" "In Cincinnati, with her husband and two kids. Got a nice house. Beautiful family. Adam likes to visit." I waited. "What happened to Adam's father?" I asked. She chewed quietly for a moment. "He was in Dayton, last I heard." She shrugged. "I guess he's still there." "You divorced?" "Never married. When I got pregnant, he just left." I digested this before I spoke. "Does he ever see Adam?" "Not once. He doesn't send a postcard, a Christmas card, or a birthday card, and he's never paid a dime in support." I felt uncomfortable even listening to this account of such epic uninterest. "Did you get a lawyer?" She shook her head. "I didn't need a lawyer. But he should..." "Leo Nolan from Canada, you don't get it, do you?" I was quiet. "It isn't about what people should or shouldn't do. It's about what they do or don't do. Why would I want anything from him if he don't want his own son?" She stared at me. "We got a homey little saying for a fella like him down here." There was a glint of steel in her eye that accompanied the half smile. "We say he can go F himself." I nodded slowly. You know, I said, we got that same homie saying up north. We stood outside the pale blue frame house. Even in the dark, the wind was blowing warm and sultry. No rain yet? I asked. Jean shook her head. Just the wind for a while. Then'll come the lightning. It'll come in sheets from the east and the north. Afterward, there'll be rain. I kissed her. It was the right thing to do because it came to me spontaneously. When I stepped back, she looked at me fondly. Last time we shook hands. I don't know what got into me, I said. It's only after 9 o'clock. I waited. You like to come upstairs for a while? Very much. Then I pondered. What about Adam? I can get him around midnight. Mom won't mind. Girl doesn't get too many nice dates she can afford to mess up when she gets to my age. I looked about me at the lights and the windows of surrounding houses, wondered who was sitting out in their front verandas. What'll the neighbors say? We got a homey little saying about that down here. I'll bet you do. She took my hand and led me up the walk. We made love that night. With the warm wind sweeping across the Appalachians, up the winding Ohio and through the open second-story windows of the house, we explored each other's bodies in the hesitant manner of all new lovers, careful, uncertain of limits. I have a memory of her outline in the darkened room, of the sway of the mattress, of the cool sheets wrapped around us, and the taste of her mouth as the lightning dashed finally in the skies, as she had said it would. And strangely, of all things, I remember the feel of her fingers as they trailed along my shoulders and how much I needed that touch. In the dimly lit room, I thought of Adam's father walking away from this woman and his son. I thought of all the things I could never comprehend, and I knew that they were just beginning. At midnight, we walked to where my car was parked behind the Scott Hotel and drove to Carter Avenue. I waited while Jean went inside her parents' bungalow and came out with a sleepy head boy in tow, then drove them back to their home. On the veranda, she opened the front door. Upstairs, she said to him, into the bathroom. I'll be up in a minute. She guided Adam through the door, closing it softly behind him. When we were alone, I held her. I felt her smile against my chest. Look, she pointed over my shoulder. I turned. Sheets of lightning without sound rippled the sky across the river. Watching the spectacle, this woman in my arms, I wondered where I was, how all this had happened. I'm not supposed to ask, she said, but I will. What? Will I see you again? I pulled her head back to my chest where it fits snugly below my neck. Yes, I breathed. Yes, and I meant it. But already I was alive with what would happen next that night. The lightning flashed at my back, leaves on the trees stirring in the wind, and I knew, even then, that I was going to see him within an hour. I stood and waited. He came out of the hospital at 1 a.m. as he had previously, and we replayed the entire walk along Lexington, 14th, the pause at the Scott, then on to Winchester. It had become a ritual like the Mass, where each step in the ceremony was ordained, cherished, and respected. When he stood across from the First Bank and Trust Company building, he put his hands in his pockets as I knew he would, turned and faced me, and once again our eyes met. There were sheets of silent lightning electrifying the air as we stood there, and I have no idea whether it was pure coincidence or not, but it happened that way. And the images that I remember are burned into my brain as white-hot flashes and heart stops in the night, as the world turned inside out, and I shared a timeless point in the universe with my uncle, who was younger than I was. I licked my lips before I spoke. Jack? He smiled, puzzled. Jack Rady? He nodded. Yes? My heart flooded with a sudden ache. I forged ahead. I'm a friend of Margaret's, a friend of your sister. In the darkness, his eyes brightened. Way down here? You're kidding. He stepped forward, closing the space between us. Do you live here? He asked. No, I'm on vacation. Margaret knew I might be down here. She gave me your address. Asked me to look you up, make sure everything's all right. He shook his head, smiling. His eyes were bright blue, like my mother's. Good old Marg, always watching out for little brother. He was both amused and pleased. Then his eyes met mine again. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. Leo. He waited for a last name. When I didn't offer it, I added, just tell her Leo dropped by to see how you were. He accepted that. I walked toward him, closing the space between us. I saw my shadow ahead of me, flickering wildly on the pavement, a transient fragment cast by the lightning with no sound. And as I neared him, the air became still and the shadow disappeared. It happened like that. I held my breath, looked around. We stood face to face, in the silence, in the dark, in the past.
That was episode 5 of Shadow of Ashland by Terence Green. The narrator was Michael Hogan. The novel is published by Forge Books of New York and distributed in Canada by H.B. Fenn and Company. This reading was produced by Dagmar Kafunka-Nunn. Next week, the story takes a mysterious twist in time and place. Our poetry nightcap also visits the past. In Bruce Taylor's poem, Lovely, it's an alluring place that's far different from the present. It's read by David Jansen.
Lovely. The past is lovely. It lasts forever. Somewhere, I'm still lying under the lawn sprinkler with no copper tone on. The grass, cool and elastic under my back. A black spaniel nuzzling my feet. The cars are old-fashioned and optimistic. The people who drive them have fallen in love with the future. They can't know that when they get here, they will love the past more. That the present will look like a stupendous machine for forcing things to stop existing. Well, to live for the moment is best. But the moments, the little jiffies, they are startled to be here, like the high-shouldered cuprous beetles that live beneath patio stones. If you're curious, you lift one up and let it run down your arm. The other ones scoot for cover, struggling down into the leaf mulch, kicking frantically.
Lovely, a poem written by Bruce Taylor and read by David Jansen. It's from Taylor's most recent collection of poetry, The Facts, published by Véhicule Press. And that's our program for this week. The coordinating producers for Between the Covers are Ann Jansen and myself, Heather Brown. Dagmar Kafunka-Nunn is the associate producer and Chris Cutress the engineer. Barb Carey is our poetry editor. Next up, CBC Radio 1 News. And that's followed by Northern Lights from CBC Winnipeg. Good night and have a pleasant weekend.